Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm Ken, reading from today's Telegraph Herald, today being Friday, September 25th. Remember that IRIS is supported in part from DUPACO and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. And we begin with our first piece from the front page. And once again, COVID takes the headlines. Area officials release new data amid spike in virus. The number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Dubuque County flew past the 3,000 mark Thursday, as 128 new cases were reported in the 24-hour period that ended at 5 p.m. That total was the highest of any 24-hour period ending at 5 p.m. since the Telegraph Herald started recording figures at that time daily on May 19th, and far surpassed any single-day total prior to that. Nearly 81 new cases per day have been reported for the county in the week that ended Thursday night, more than double the prior week, which itself was continuing an upward trend of increasing numbers of cases, while the county's 14-day positivity rate also climbed. As of 5 p.m. Thursday, the county's 14-day rate stood at 27.9%, according to the TH's calculations. Based on state-reported totals, the county had recorded 805 new confirmed cases and 2,883 new tests during the prior 2 weeks. However, the TH calculations continue to far exceed the state's reported 14-day positivity rate due to Iowa's practice of not counting recent confirmed cases until all data is received, such as the date of birth of the testee. This practice drives down the positivity rate, even though those cases have been confirmed in a specific county. At 5 p.m. Thursday, the state reported Dubuque County's 14-day positivity rate as 16.6%. What's causing the surge? Well, local public health officials point to a variety of factors. "I'm basing a lot of those cases on events," said Dubuque County Public Health Director Patrice Lambert on Wednesday. "We have tractor pulls going on, car shows going on, ATV rallies, weddings. There are still a lot of mass gatherings." She said she believed that one problem is these events are outdoors, which might lower the guard even of people who are taking the coronavirus seriously. "At lots of them are occurring outside, where the distance and mask wearing are not enforced as much as we educate on a daily basis," Lambert said. And she expects that these events are likely to continue, so the positive case counts are going to continue to rise. "We're going to see more and more events before winter," Lambert said. "Our first blizzard will be a good thing for us in some ways, because people will be forced to stay inside with their families rather than go outside and gather. Until we get a vaccine, that social distancing is going to be crucial." In a video update released Thursday, City of Dubuque Public Health Specialist Mary Rose Corrigan also cited K-12 schools and colleges being back in session and community spread as other factors driving the increase. But just how many confirmed cases are tied to the county's higher education institutions is unclear, as those reached by the TH said they only periodically update the data. Clark University was reporting 29 cases as of Tuesday. Northeast Iowa Community College had 19 cases as of September 18th. Loras College had 37 cases as of September 17th. And University of Dubuque had 28 cases as of September 16th. As of Thursday, Dubuque Community Schools reported 19 infected students and 13 staff. Western Dubuque Community School District had 16 students and 7 staff with COVID-19. Holy Family Catholic Schools reported 11 cases, all at Wallert Catholic High School. While Dubuque County Board of Health members this week approved soon releasing COVID-19 data by zip code, local public health officials this week also shared more detailed information regarding the ages of those infected with the virus. The Dubuque County Public Health Incident Management Team on Tuesday shared a graphic that shared age data from the Iowa Department of Public Health. It covered all Dubuque County positive cases through Monday, with most age groups broken down to five-year increments. At that time, 22% of all cases had been confirmed in 19 to 24-year-olds, easily the most of any age group. That was followed by 9% in the 25 to 29 range and 8% in the 15 to 18 group. Each five-year age group from 30 to 34 to 60 to 64 accounted for 5% to 7% of the county's to-date case count. 4% of cases were in children 10 and younger, while 2% was children 11 to 14. A total of 12% of cases were in residents 65 and older. We have an inset box to give us an idea of what's been happening. It's COVID-19 dates of note. Dates at which the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Dubuque County reached notable milestones. First case announced on March 19th. 500 cases, June 28th. 1,000 cases, July 14th. 1,500 cases, August 2nd. 2,000 cases, August 30th. 2,500 cases, September 17th. 3,000 cases, September 24th. So in looking at these numbers, what we're seeing is what seems to be obvious. They're rising at a much more rapid rate as the summer and now fall have continued. Well, back to our front page and what looks like a pleasant piece. We have a large picture inset with a young lady. Sitting next to her is a white dog. And she's sitting on the curb by Clark University. Or, excuse me, not Clark, Loras. I see that in the background. Loras College student, Sierra Hansen, along with her service dog, Toxie, on Wednesday. Group brings canines to Loras. A yellow English Labrador is among the newest members of the Loras College campus community this fall. Toxie, a service dog in training, goes to classes with the sophomore Sierra Hansen to help her classmates adjust to seeing service animals at the school. That will come in handy as students start to take on an active role in training service dogs on campus. A lot of people think that it's just a pet, that you can go up to her and talk to her and pet her, Hansen said. Seeing the vest, I think it starts to click with them that this isn't a regular dog. Hansen is the president and founder of Do Dogs, a Loras club through which students raise and train service dogs and spread awareness of the roles the animals play. Eventually, students will start training dogs on behalf of Cedar Rapids, Iowa nonprofit Definitely Dogs. Their efforts will help the nonprofit serve more people while helping community members understand the impact that service dogs can have, said Sherry Stein Ross, a co-founder of the organization. It's just an amazing service that students can offer to the community, she said. Hansen started raising and training service dogs with her mother when Hansen was in high school. During Hansen's freshman year at Loras, she established Do Dogs to continue her efforts. This year, students in the group are raising funds to support their efforts to bring dogs to campus. They also are talking to the Loras community about how to act appropriately around service dogs. Hansen worked with Definitely, that's spelled D-E-A-F, Definitely Dogs, to host Toxie, I think I'm pronouncing that right, T-O-K-S-I, Toxie, at Loras, so people can get used to having a service animal on campus. Toxie's presence also serves to help the wider Dubuque community learn more about service animals, Hansen said. A lot of people just love seeing her, she said. I'll walk in a class and I'll just see everyone brighten up. Do Dogs members plan to bring 3 or 4 dogs to campus next year. Each dog will have a student as a head trainer, and other members of the group will help with the process. Definitely Dogs will provide the students with puppies to live with on campus and will visit with students to give training classes and provide instruction so students have the skills to work with the dogs, Ross said. The animals eventually will be placed as post-traumatic stress disorder dogs, hearing dogs, or professional facility dogs. It takes 2 years, but beginning to end, students will be part of the process, from the potty training to the placement, Ross said. College campuses can serve as valuable training grounds for service dogs because the animals are exposed to diverse environments with people from different cultures and with different abilities. They have to be exposed to as many things as possible because it's all new to them if they haven't seen it, Ross said. The students' efforts allow Definitely Dogs to train more service animals and in turn place them with more people, she said. While they are raising dogs, Do Dogs members also will assist with efforts such as marketing, fundraising, and outreach, said Jake Kurzek, an assistant professor of neuroscience and psychology who serves as Do Dogs' advisor. Those efforts, in turn, allow students to significantly impact the life of whoever eventually receives the dogs, Kurzek said. I think it's a good highlight for showing students who are dedicated to taking their learning in the classroom and applying it in the community, he said. And now our final front page piece, marriage rates down for 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic and related restrictions have led to a significant decrease in the number of couples getting married in Dubuque County this year, but the figures are starting to climb. Only 332 marriages have been recorded in 2020 as of Thursday, according to county officials. That is more than 130 fewer than the average at this time of year in the previous 4 years. In the four prior years, September was the most common month for Dubuque County marriages, according to data from the county's recorder's office. In 2017, 2018, and 2019, about 100 marriages were recorded in September alone. This year, only 40 marriages had been recorded this month as of Thursday morning. However, the numbers have been ticking up in recent months, including 70 in August. County Recorder John Murphy said he has heard in recent weeks of more people deciding to hold some sort of ceremony or stop pushing off their marriage date, despite the pandemic. I think a lot of society is saying, we need to get on with our lives, he said. And a lot of that is coming from Iowa's response, or lack of response, that allows events to occur without many restrictions. Murphy also noted that there is a 3-day waiting period between signing a marriage license application and when a marriage can take place. Couples can ask a judge to waive the waiting period if needed, which is typically done when one person in a couple is about to be deployed to the military or falls ill, he said. However, in this pandemic-affected year, he said, he has asked a judge to waive the waiting period for several couples that ultimately decided at the last minute that they want to be legally married on the initial wedding date they set, even though they postponed a larger traditional wedding ceremony. It's been a unique curveball that you don't expect, Murphy said. The lower marriage numbers contrast to other areas of the recorder's office that have seen big jumps during the pandemic, Murphy noted, including land and boat purchases that have skyrocketed over the summer. As a county magistrate, Matt Bolin said he has done several ceremonies outside, allowing people to socially distance, and he recently officiated a friend's wedding that functioned just like a typical pre-pandemic ceremony, except with masks. However, he has done most weddings in the courthouse since the pandemic began. Some courtrooms only can have a maximum capacity of 6 people with COVID-19 restrictions. The biggest courtroom in the Dubuque County Courthouse allows for up to 32 people, but that room is often in use for many other purposes, he said. However, Bolin said he hasn't heard of any pushback or complaints on the amount of people allowed in the courtroom at a time. Those courtroom ceremonies only usually have 6 to 10 people there anyway. And the monthly marriage totals very quickly to show how things have been going. January 24, February 29, March 23, now April 15, May 35, June 42, July 54, August 70, September 40. We have one more piece that's on page 2. Feds put first black inmate to death since execution restart. It's from Terre Haute, Indiana. A man who killed a religious couple visiting Texas from Iowa was executed Thursday, the first black inmate put to death as part of the Trump administration's resumption of federal executions after a nearly 20-year pause. Christopher Villalva, 40, was pronounced dead shortly before 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time after receiving a lethal injection at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. In a last statement, Villalva asked God to comfort the families of the couple he had killed in 1999, saying, "Father, heal their hearts with grace and love." After robbing and locking Todd and Stacy Bagley in the trunk of their car, the then 19-year-old Villalva shot them in the head and burned their bodies in the car. Vialva's final words were, "I'm ready, Father." Villalva turned toward his mother behind a glass window in a witness room as the lethal injections began. "He was looking at me when he died," his mother, Lisa Brown, told the Associated Press in a text message, confirming she attended the execution. The execution comes during demonstrations, disappointment, violence, and sadness in Louisville, Kentucky, after a grand jury did not charge the officers who shot Breonna Taylor with her death, rather filing lower-level felonies for shooting into neighboring homes. Federal authorities executed just 3 prisoners in the previous 56 years. Death penalty foes accuse President Donald Trump of restarting them to help stake a claim as the law and order candidate. Otto said one black juror and 11 white jurors recommended the death sentence in 2000 after prosecutors told them Villalva led a black gang faction in Killeen, Texas, and killed to boost his gang status. That claim, Otto said, was false and only served to conjure up menacing stereotypes. Now we continue with news from Dubuque and the Tri-States. And at the top of the fold, we have Dubuque County again sets one day high. And I'll just read a little of this. We've had it from the front page. A total of 128 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Dubuque County were reported between 5 p.m. Wednesday and 5 p.m. Thursday, a record total for a 24-hour period ending at 5 p.m. The previous high was 115 cases set over the weekend. There were 437 new tests reported during that time period, so the county's positivity rate was 29.2%. The county's to-date positivity rate climbed to 10.7% as of 5 p.m. With 805 new confirmed cases and 2,883 new case tests during the past 2 weeks, the county's 14-day positivity rate as of 5 p.m. Thursday climbed to 27.9%. There's a huge difference between that and what the state and the county also seem to be reporting, and similar gulfs were seen in other Iowa counties, according to the TH calculations. Statewide, Iowa's case total increased by 1,206 during the 24-hour span to reach 83,588. 8 more related deaths were reported, so that tally climbed to 1,302. And continuing on that, we have Joe Davies nears tipping point from Elizabeth. When Jackie Jacobs reopened Cajun Jack's Bar and Grill in Elizabeth in May, it took a while before the business returned to its normal routine while implementing new safety measures. Jacobs expanded the outdoor patio, pushed the inside tables 6 feet apart, and purchased gallons of sanitizer. But rising COVID-19 positivity rates in the region of the state that includes Joe Davies County soon could force Jacobs and other business owners like hers to adjust yet again. "It is for sure rough," she said. "We already had it hard enough with what we are having to deal with." The most recent data from the Illinois Department of Public Health shows that, as of Monday, the 9-county region that included Joe Davies County had a 7-day positivity average of 7.7%, and that rate has increased for 6 straight days. If the region reaches at least 8% for 3 consecutive days, state-ordered restrictions will be imposed. Joe Davies County Health Administrator Sandra Schleicher said those measures will include restricting gatherings to no more than 25 people, closing all indoor dining at restaurants, and early closures and limited hours for bars and restaurants. Those restrictions, then, would be in place until the region records a positivity rate of less than 6.5% for 3 consecutive days. It will probably affect most of the businesses, Schleicher said. While the region includes more populated counties and the much larger cities of Freeport and Rockford, Schleicher said Joe Davies County's positivity rate recently topped 8% as more cases are being reported. Unfortunately, our county isn't showing that much difference than the bigger cities, she said. County Board Chairman Scott Toot said it is unfair that a less populated county like Joe Davies County could face restrictions even if its positivity rate is lower than the major metros in its region. But he also said that if residents follow recommended health practices, it will lower those rates. I wish they would go on a county-by-county basis, but they don't do that, he said. I also wish they would take a look at towns within the county. Toot said county board members are putting together a proposed ordinance that, if approved, would include fines of up to $750 per day if residents do not quarantine after being told to do so by the health department. We are just trying to educate people, he said. My message is everyone needs to cooperate with the guidelines. Mike Meyer, the owner of The Other Side in East Dubuque, said the past few months have been difficult for his business. If the region hits the threshold that triggers additional restrictions, it could be another significant blow. It's devastating because you have to be under 6.5% for 3 consecutive days to get back, he said. Most places, it's taken 2 to 3 weeks to do that. That's just devastating to us. And now we turn to our opinion page, and today's opinion column is letters to the editor, and we have 3. Our first one, Trump should set example by wearing a mask, from Roger Myers, Pasadena Court, Dubuque. In one of President Trump's August interviews with Bob Woodward, he stated there was nothing more could have been done to stem the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, there is one simple thing he could have done and still refuses to do. Wear a mask and strongly encourage everyone else to do the same. His insistence on making mask wearing a political rather than a health issue has undoubtedly led us to the unenviable position we're in today, the world leader in infectious rates. And until he changes his attitude or is voted out of office, this crisis will continue to bounce around indefinitely from state to state. Even the eventual release of a safe and effective vaccine won't be the magic bullet we'd like, since it may not be viable for everyone, and some people may refuse to take it. So, Mr. Trump, step up and be the leader we need. Swallow your ego and pride and admit, just for once, maybe you're wrong. Start wearing a mask and strongly encourage your supporters to do the same, especially at the closely packed rallies you love so much. After all, as the president has said about some of the weird concoctions he promoted in the past, what can it hurt? Our second letter, What's Motivating Conservative Republicans? From Daniel Boxleiter, Green Street, Dubuque. I'm sorry, but I just don't get it. I get being a conservative Republican and believing in smaller government. I get voting for candidates that live and reflect the beliefs that you feel are important. I get the fear that liberal Democrats will push the pendulum too far to the left. I get voting Republican because you've always voted Republican, don't like politics, and pay no attention to anything that is going on in Washington. Although I find the last one hard to believe, given all that is going on in America and the number of outlets pushing political information in all directions, I get it. The thing I will never get is the underlying devotion and allegiance to Donald Trump. He is not a conservative Republican. He does not care about smaller government. I can't imagine anyone looking at Donald Trump and thinking, I hope my son grows up to be just like him. As for the pendulum, there is no doubt that Trump has pushed it to the right. But what will truly conservative Republicans do when Trump pushes the pendulum past its breaking point and the Constitution becomes the Trumpstitution? I know to a small segment of the population, that is when America becomes great again. But I cannot believe that truly conservative Republicans would feel the same. Maybe that is where my inability to get it finds its real question. Have truly conservative Republicans, in the image of Ronald Reagan, become extinct, gone into hibernation, or just given up? And our third and final letter, examine cost of abandoning ethics and values. From Barbara Rank, Hidden Oaks Court, Dubuque. But at what cost? By prioritizing the right to life of the new unborn, do we neglect to also address the loss of life due to a spreading pandemic, poverty, and racial injustice? Does a good economy that rewards the stock market blind us to the needs of the working poor and those who struggle to make ends meet? Does denying our contribution to the endangerment of our environment excuse turning a blind eye to the increasingly destructive forces of nature, water, wind, and fire? By focusing on Supreme Court justices and the economy, have we compromised ourselves into accepting the lying, cheating, and lawlessness that have brought about our desired results? How much more political graft and corruption can we overlook to achieve our ends? We may be getting what we want, but at what price? At what point is sacrificing our ethics, values, humanity, and moral conscience too great a cost? You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, and we are reading from the September 25th Friday edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, sponsored in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. And this is Ken sitting in the reader's seat, and we now turn to today's obituaries. Francis J. Simi, Platteville, Wisconsin. Francis J. Simi, 93, of Platteville, Wisconsin, passed away peacefully at Divine Rehab and Nursing, Fenimore, on Monday, September 21st. Francis was born February 20th, 1927, at Montfort to Wesley and Anna Froelich Washburn. Francis was the eldest of six children. She attended Livingston Schools and graduated valedictorian and then went on to graduate from UW-Platteville. She married Ronald O. Syme on August 7, 1945. They lived in Platteville, Galena, Mineral Point, and then moved to Guam in 1956 for 9 years before returning to Platteville. Francis taught for several years and was church secretary and treasurer for many years. She was also on the library board and delivered mobile meals. Francis had many talents, interests, and hobbies, which included cooking, baking, vegetable and flower gardening, sewing, weaving, knitting, crocheting, and winemaking. She was a devoted member of First English Lutheran Church and volunteered much of her time and energy to church activities and loved her church community. She enjoyed going to their Wascott cabin and always called it the cottage. She loved spending time with her family, friends, and grandchildren, and Christmas was her special holiday. She was very involved with her husband's scouting activities. Fran's life was a life well lived, with concern and kindness for everyone. Francis was married 65 years and had 3 sons. Memorials can be made to First English Lutheran Church in Platteville. Due to the pandemic, there will be a private burial and private family celebration of life at a later time. Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville, is serving the family. Online condolences can be made at www.melbyfh.com. Barbara R. Sands, Farley, Iowa, Portage, Wisconsin. Barb Rose Sands, knee Blazer, age 52, of Farley, Iowa, Portage, Wisconsin, passed away Wednesday, September 23rd. She was born October 6, 1967, to Jean and Diane Giese Balzer. Her childhood was spent living in rural Partyville, Wisconsin. Barb had wonderful memories of attending Marshallon Elementary School. She especially enjoyed playing outside, building forts, and sledding downhill. Barb felt privileged to attend the small country school. She graduated in 1986 from Pardeeville High School, where Barb played volleyball and softball. Funeral services will be held Sunday, September 27th at 3 p.m. at Grassy Funeral Home, 119 Industrial Drive, Pardeeville, with Father Gary Crayenberth Bull presiding. The service will be live streamed. Visitation will be held from noon until the time of the funeral service. Social distancing and masks are required. Online condolences may be made at www.grassefs.com. Grassy Funeral Home and Services in Pardeeville is serving the family. Joseph J. Gudenkoff, New Vienna, Iowa. Joseph James Gudenkoff, 39, of New Vienna and formerly of West Des Moines, passed away Tuesday, September 22nd at his home after a long battle with cancer. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, September 27th at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville, and visitation will continue Monday from 9 to 10 a.m. at Kramer Funeral Home prior to the funeral service. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, September 28th at St. Boniface Catholic Church, New Vienna, with burial in St. Francis Cemetery in Dyersville. Joe was born August 25th, 1981, in Dubuque, Iowa, the son of Ron and Alice Recker Gudenkoff. He graduated from Beckman High School with the class of 2000 and earned his associate degree from Wyoming Tech. He worked as an automotive service manager at several dealerships. Joe especially loved his children and the time he spent with them. He also enjoyed hunting, fishing, snow skiing, snowmobiling, water skiing, and boating. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.kramerfuneral.com. Sister Jean M. Byrne, BVM. Sister Jean M. Byrne, BVM, Jean Francis, 94, of 1100 Carmel Drive, Dubuque, Iowa, died Wednesday, September 23rd at Caritas Center. Visitation in the Marion Hall Chapel will be at 10:45 on Friday, September 25th, followed immediately by the natural burial rite of committal at 11 a.m. Burial is in the Mount Carmel Cemetery. Sharing of memories via Zoom will be at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, October 1st, followed by a memorial mass in the Marion Hall Chapel at 10:45. Sister Jean ministered as a secondary teacher in Des Moines and West Des Moines, Iowa, and as an elementary teacher in Council Bluffs, Iowa, Chicago, and Butte, Montana. She served the congregation as BVM Personnel Office Director and BVM Archives Volunteer. She was born November 13, 1925, in Chicago, to Francis and Anne McClellan Byrne. She entered the BVM congregation September 8, 1943, from St. Charles Borromeo Parish, Chicago. She professed first vows March 19, 1946, and final vows August 15, 1951. Memorials may be given to Sisters of Charity BVM Support Fund, 1100 Carmel Drive, Dubuque, Iowa, 52003. I know for certain if you want to support any of the memorial places that are mentioned in our obituaries, you can find them by simply contacting the funeral homes. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in care of the arrangements. Condolences can be sent to the family by visiting Sister Jean's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Betty Landis, Elkader. Betty Landis, 61, of Elkader, died on Thursday, September 24th at Copper Creek Assisted Living in West Union. A private family service will be held at a later date. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Elkader is assisting the family. Mary L. Green, Cascade. Mary L. Green, 74, of Cascade, died Wednesday, September 23rd. Arrangements are pending at Rife Funeral Home in Cascade. And while we're on this page, we have quite a number of pieces of news in brief that we'll take care of right here. They're all pretty much local ones. Our first is police. Dubuque woman arrested for repeatedly selling crack. Police said a crack dealer was arrested this week after a confidential informant made five purchases from her in June and July.
Antoinette G. Baker, 35, of 2119 Romberg, apartment 4, was arrested Wednesday in the 1400 block of Central Avenue on a warrant charging 5 counts of possession of crack cocaine with intent to deliver. Court documents state that the charges stem from 5 sales of crack that Baker made to one confidential informant. Those sales occurred June 1, 3, and 10 at Baker's residence, on July 2nd at Flora Park, and on July 9th at a Dubuque hotel. Police reported that the sales were documented using a covert recording device and a covert camera on the informant, whose name was not released. Documents state that on July 2nd, Baker had agreed to deliver $100 worth of crack to the informant, but when she arrived at the meetup location, she noticed a Dubuque Drug Task Force vehicle parked in the area conducting surveillance. Baker contacted the informant and moved the sale to Flora Park. An arrest warrant for Baker was issued September 17th. Police: multiple people injured when driver runs red light. Police said multiple people were injured Saturday when a driver ran a red light and caused a 3-car crash in Dubuque. Jennifer L. Eads, 40, of Dubuque, was taken by ambulance to Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital for treatment, according to a police report obtained Thursday. It also states that passengers in Eads' vehicle were transported for treatment, but did not include the exact number of passengers or their names. The crash occurred at about 9:15 p.m. Saturday at the intersection of Dodge Street and Cedar Cross Road. The report states that Melanie E. Lurin, 18, of Masonville, Iowa, was westbound on Dodge when she drove through a red light at the intersection and struck Eads' vehicle, which was going north on Cedar Cross with a green light. The crash caused Eads' vehicle to spin and strike the vehicle of Ryan M. McCullough, 30, of Dubuque. Lurin was cited with failure to respond to a steady red light signal. Dyersville felon sentenced to nearly 6 years in prison for weapons possession. A repeat felon from Dyersville who was in possession of guns was sentenced today, to nearly 6 years in federal prison. Alan Osterkamp, 29, was sentenced in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to 5 years, 10 months in prison after previously pleading guilty to being a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. He must serve 3 years of supervised release after his prison term. There is no parole in the federal system. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Osterkamp admitted to unlawfully possessing a stolen gun in March 2017 and having more than 8 guns around that time. A press release states that his prior felony convictions included possession of a precursor with intent to manufacture methamphetamine, operating a motor vehicle without consent, and theft. He also twice had been convicted of domestic abuse. Local Friends of the Poor fundraising walk set for Saturday. The annual St. Vincent de Paul Friends of the Poor Walk Run event will be held Saturday, September 26th in Dubuque. Registration starts at 8:30 a.m. and the walk will be held at 9 a.m. at St. Columbkill Catholic Church, 1240 Rush Street. Proceeds raised during the event benefit the programs of Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Worm Bin Composting Workshop to be held. A workshop on composting food scraps using indoor worm bins will be held Saturday, September 26th. The workshop will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. at Swiss Valley Nature Center, according to Dubuque Metropolitan Area Solid Waste Agency and Dubuque County Conservation Board. Participants will build their own worm bin to take home and make it into a family project. Worms will be provided. One composting bin will be provided for each family. The program will be conducted outside to maintain social distancing guidelines. Registration is $10 and can be made by calling 563-556-6745. UD lands $1.3 million federal grant. A Dubuque university has landed a $1.3 million federal grant. University of Dubuque announced Thursday that it has received a federal student support services grant of about $1.3 million, payable over 5 years, to help more students succeed in and graduate from college.
SSS helps college students who are low income, first generation, those whose parents do not have a four-year college degree, or students with disabilities, states a UD press release. The services the grant provides are comprehensive and include academic tutoring, financial planning advice, career and college mentoring, help in choosing courses, and other forms of assistance. Such services enhance academic success and make it more likely that students will graduate or transfer with the lowest possible debt. Pedestrian hit by vehicle and injured. Dubuque police said a woman was injured Thursday after she was struck by a driver who didn't see her crossing the road. Mercedes M. Hines, 25, of Dubuque, was injured but declined to be transported to a hospital by ambulance, according to a police report. The incident occurred at about 1:30 p.m. Thursday at the intersection of White and West 5th Streets. The report states that a vehicle driven by Jacob J. Bartholomew, 34, of Dubuque, was stopped at the intersection. He then started turning left onto White and struck Hines as she was crossing the street. Police said Bartholomew didn't see Hines. Bartholomew was cited with failure to yield to a pedestrian within an intersection. And now we move back to some more news from our tri-state area. Platteville schools struggle with virus and remote learning. From Platteville. Following two confirmed COVID-19 cases at Platteville High School, school district leaders have delayed plans to increase in-person instruction days in October. But administrators are feeling the pressure to increase face-to-face class time as the district experiences high rates of absenteeism and disengagement on virtual days. The attendance is a nightmare, said middle school principal Jason Julius. In August, district school board members approved a hybrid model of teaching in which students can attend school 100% virtually or have face-to-face classes part of each week. Presently, students in grades 7 through 12 who registered for in-person instruction attend classes on 2 days per week, with the remaining days taught virtually. Students in pre-kindergarten through 6th grade attend in-person 4 days per week and virtually on the 5th. Administrators intended to increase face-to-face instruction to 4 days per week for grades 7 through 10. But those plans were nixed Wednesday after the county released updated COVID-19 case counts and the district was informed that 2 cases were reported at the high school. District leaders now have proposed transitioning 7th and 8th graders to 4 days of face-to-face instruction on October 5th, following suit with grades 9 through 12 on November 2nd. I believe it's important that we as a district, we continue to keep that option open, said Superintendent Jim Bobel. Doing so only will occur after administrators reassess the spread of COVID-19, which has escalated in Platteville in recent weeks. In the 2 weeks that ended on Wednesday, Grant County averaged about 27 confirmed cases per day. During that time, about 68% of new cases, or more than 18 per day on average, have been Platteville residents, according to the County Health Department. More than 170 COVID-19 cases have been University of Wisconsin-Platteville students and staff. The Platteville School District does not mandate testing, but students who display COVID-19 symptoms are sent home. School board member Arian Ulhog had reservations about increasing face-to-face instruction without full knowledge of the case count among the student body. Asymptomatic students who are positive for COVID-19 likely are attending classes, yet the district is unable to monitor the spread without testing, he said. But a significant percentage of students are challenged by the current hybrid learning model, incurring virtual absences for either part of the entire day, principals said. Sometimes students attend virtual video meetings but do not complete assignments. It's not 5 or 10 students, it's 120 students, said Platteville High School principal Jacob Crace. It is not for lack of access to technology, principals said. The district already provides students with computers and can offer families internet hotspots. Principals said staff are challenged to meet with students in need of additional support because they must teach classes throughout the school day. School board member Colleen McCabe encouraged administrators to establish learning pods in which struggling students could visit the school and work with a designated staff member. Those things are definitely being explored.
And we have a number of continuing news and briefs from our tri-state area and Dubuque as well. A Dubuque man pleads guilty to heroin charges. A Dubuque man who sold heroin that led to an overdose and who requested sexual favors for drugs pleaded guilty Thursday to a federal charge. Michael J. Greenwood, 26, pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to distribution of a controlled substance near a protected location resulting in serious injury. He faces 1 to 40 years in prison and up to a lifetime of supervised release after his prison term. There is no parole in the federal system. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office and court documents, Greenwood admitted to selling heroin in Dubuque from 2016 to 2018. On August 24, 2018, he sold $100 worth of heroin to two women while within 1,000 feet of Jackson and Madison Parks. After using the heroin, one of the women lost consciousness and started having trouble breathing, the release states. The woman's family members rushed her to the hospital where she was revived with Narcan, saving her life. The release also states that he sometimes requested sexual favors from his customers in exchange for heroin. Greenwood initially also was charged with use of a communications facility, in this case Facebook, to commit a drug offense, but that charge was dropped.
Darlington School opts to go all virtual. From Darlington, Wisconsin. All pre-kindergarten through 8th grade students in the Darlington School District will switch to virtual learning starting Monday, September 28th, district officials announced Thursday. The decision was triggered when school administrators learned of two additional COVID-19 cases in the Darlington Elementary Middle School building. District officials had learned of two other cases earlier this week. Classes will not be held, and teachers will prepare for the transition on Friday, September 25th. All pre-kindergarten through 8th grade extracurricular activities and practices also are canceled until students return to the building Monday, October 12th. 4-year-old kindergarten classes at community partner locations also will cease during the same time period. Delaware County School earns national recognition. From Delhi, a Delaware County school has garnered national recognition for the performance of its students. U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos announced on Thursday that Maquoketa Valley Middle School in Delhi was a national Blue Ribbon school for 2020. It is one of 6 such schools in the state and 367 nationwide. No other local schools received the designation. The school was honored as being among the state's highest performing schools as measured by state assessments or nationally normed tests, according to a press release. The 2020 National Blue Ribbon Schools Awards ceremony will be held virtually on November 12th and 13th. Back at the editorial page, I do want to share this one. It's under what's called the verbatim column, where they get editorials from other parts of the nation. Rage is out of control. Police officers shouldn't be attacked or killed just because they've chosen the dangerous job to protect and serve their fellow citizens. Nor should black and brown people be injured or killed by cops because of the color of their skin. But as those types of tragedies continue to occur in America, they feed a national sense of fear and rage. Most recently, the horrific shooting of 2 Compton, California sheriff's deputies as they sat in their marked SUV ratcheted up that rage. The shooting, captured on video, showed a lone gunman run up to the window and shoot the officers multiple times. A crowd that formed outside the hospital where the officers were treated reportedly shouted, "Death to police!" and "We hope they die!" while they tried to block emergency entrances. It seems obvious that none of this advances police reform, reduces gun violence, or protects people of color from excessive force at the hands of police. Instead, it creates more anger and division. Some use social media to make matters worse, such as by hijacking the legitimate purpose of Black Lives Matter to promote violence and by publishing anti-police screeds. A recent report from the Network Contagion Research Institute documents the online use of toxic anti-police slogans, some of which include images of cops being shot or squad cars burning. The research group also reports that right-wing extremists, including white supremacists, have been active on social media and have been responsible for more violence nationally, according to federal officials. Those responsible for carrying out that violence, including the shooter in Compton, must be held accountable, and the difficult work of meaningful reform in law enforcement must continue. Americans are better than this. After that, let's see if we can conclude with something a little more upbeat. Our weekend buzz, the noteworthy things to do this weekend. In Warren, Illinois, the Pumpkin Festival, today through Sunday, downtown Warren. The event will include food, entertainment, arts and crafts, a parade, and a car and tractor show. Those attending are asked to practice social distancing. March for Refugee Rights, Saturday in Dubuque, noon to 1 p.m. The event will begin across the street from Loras College's Christ the King Chapel, continue to University of Dubuque, and end at Clark University. Co-sponsored by Iowa United Nations Association, proceeds will support UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Face coverings will be required. Suggested donation is $20 for adults, $10 for students. Register or donate at www.iowauna.org. Cypress Apple Festival weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Cypress Apple Orchard, 8610 US 52. 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. Lunch will be available on the grounds, as well as homemade caramel apples, apple pies, cider, and cider donuts. Those are really good. Pumpkins and activities for children. Admission is free. And we have the final one, All-State Barn Tour. Saturday and Sunday, Clayton, Delaware, Dubuque, Jackson, and Jones counties in Iowa. 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. each day. The Iowa Barn Foundation's annual tour will include 7 area barns in addition to others across the state. Masks are required. Visitors do not have to get out of their cars to view each site. For a complete listing of barns, visit iowabarnfoundation.org/tours. And my friends, that brings us to the end of the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Friday, September 25th. This has been brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the blind and print handicapped, supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken, who's been reading most faithfully with you and enjoying every moment of it. And until you hear my voice again, take care out there. Be wise in what you do. Until we meet again, take care. Bye-bye.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.